I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we have more on that Mexican-American Studies program that was recently banned from the Tucson, Arizona public school system. Yesterday, we heard from the state superintendent of instruction, who was a key player in getting the program out of the Tucson schools. Today, we want to get another perspective. We'll hear from a supporter of the program. That's coming up. But first, we want to go back to presidential politics. And if you live in the early primary states, and even if you don't, you probably have already been hearing a lot of things like this.
Romney once bragged he's even more liberal than Ted Kennedy on social issues. Why would we ever vote for someone who's just like Obama when we can unite around Rick Santorum and beat Obama?
That ad is running in South Carolina, where candidates are flooding the airwaves ahead of this weekend's primary. Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, of course, is not the only candidate being targeted. Other negative ads call Newt Gingrich's politics, quote, desperate, and Rick Santorum a, quote, counterfeit conservative. We wanted to talk more about these ads. Voters say they can't stand them. So why do candidates keep using them? We've called on Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, to talk about that. But we're also interested in the history of negative campaigning in general. And for that, we've called upon Rose Marie Osler. She is author of the book Slinging Mud: Rude Nicknames, Scurrilous Slogans, and Insulting Slang from Two Centuries of American Politics. She's also a freelance writer. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
Thanks.
Now, Ron, a new survey from the Pew Research Center says that half of Americans already think that the campaign so far has been too negative. That number is nearly double what it was in February of 2008. So I just want to get your take, Ron, and you've covered so many of these. Is it really true? Is it really more negative this year than it was at this time last time?
I'll accept the judgment of the voters. If people think it's more negative, I suppose it is more negative. I mean, you have to go with that perception, because that is the only real measure we have of how much more negative it is. We can look subjectively at the ads and we can say, you know, this one's nastier. But there has been already one concerted effort to bring down one candidate. That was to say, the independent groups that went after Newt Gingrich in Iowa, they did it. He was the front runner. He was dropped way back into the pack by those negative ads. People don't like negative ads, but they work like gangbusters.
That was going to be my question. Is that since voters say they hate them so much, why do candidates keep using
them? They use them because they work. And we've seen it again and again. When an ad has a particular message to get across, that message gets into the public's mind. Down in South Carolina, $8 million so far just on broadcast stations, not counting cables. This is an enormous amount of money in a state of that size. I mean, we're not talking California, New York, Miami here, or Florida here. We're talking about a relatively small state with relatively inexpensive media markets. And to spend that kind of money in just a 2 or 3 week period is absolute saturation coverage. You cannot avoid getting the message.
I want to talk more about South Carolina in a minute, because that's a place where people, it's become kind of part of the folklore that campaigning is particularly, you know, nasty, negative, tough, whatever you want to call it down there. I want to check your perception on whether that's really true. But first, Rose Marie Osler, you know, we always say just about every year, oh, it's so terrible. It's so much worse now than it was, you know, X years ago. Is that really true?
You know, I don't think so, really. I think that we feel when things are happening, and especially now when we've got the internet and everybody's blogging and television going all the time. And I think we feel like we're really bombarded with negative ads, and we can't believe that it's always been like this. But when I started looking at some of the ads that people were running, really more in the form of, say, newspaper editorials or handing out pamphlets, they have always been pretty nasty and over the top. So I think in terms of content, it's actually, surprisingly not that much different.
You were telling us earlier that in a lot of ways it was actually worse in the 19th century, because people were more upfront about attacking people personally, their looks, their background, saying they didn't speak good grammar. I assume that there were, you know, racial references to at a time when, you know, certain races were not deemed to be worthy to participate in public life, and there are references to perhaps that there was the taint of that in that sort of background. So true. People were just more upfront about it. There was no code language needed.
Right. Yeah. I think that is true. I think that the boundaries have changed a little bit. Abraham Lincoln was ridiculed for his looks and the fact that he was not well educated, and according to some people, didn't speak good grammar, or he was this he had been traveling around making speeches, and people really thought his homey style was inappropriate for a president. And I think, and this was stuff that was appearing in mainstream newspapers on editorial pages. So it was much more up front and center, you know, that kind of thing that I think you could really get by with now.
And wasn't it the case that people could pay people to put these kinds of columns in newspapers back then? Isn't that the case? That there wasn't this sense of an ethical boundary, that people would just pay people to say certain things. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, people wrote, one of the good methods was for people to write these unsigned editorials. And newspapers were partisan back then. They didn't really make some pretense of reporting neutral news. They just were for the candidate they were for. And so I guess to keep the editor from writing all of it, you know, other people would be in there writing things, often under a pseudonym or with no signature.
But did the things that people talk about, was it true? I mean, was any of this stuff based on truth, or was it just entirely made up? Was there any boundary about that?
I think that there was some of both. There's always the issue of, are you putting a negative spin on something that actually sort of happened, or that's kind of a fact, or are you just simply making things up? And there was, you know, some of both, I think.
Hmm. And Ron Elving, I think, is it fair to say that the kind of today's version of the unsigned editorial is the super PAC ad?
Yes. No one really knows who the super PAC is. No one knows for sure where the money is coming from. The disclosure rules are quite different. And by law, the super PAC is independent from any of the candidates. So even if we all know, and even Mitt Romney on the debate stage the other night referred to, quote, my super PAC, even with that, we do not absolutely know who the characters are. They're somewhat shadowy, who are putting all of these ads on. We just know whom they are against.
Well, here's an example of that. It's very clear who this is against. Here it is. Here's a super PAC ad.
Newt Gingrich's attacks are called foolish, out of bounds, and disgusting. Newt attacks because he has more baggage than the airlines. Don't be fooled by Newt's desperate attacks.
This is from a super PAC called Restore Our Future. So,
you get a lot of information about the super PAC from their names. Not.
That's NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Also with us, Rosemarie Osler. She's author of the book Slinging Mud, which traces campaign attacks since the 1820s. Rosemarie, you made an interesting point. You said that you think blogging and the fact that people can comment contributes to our sense that the campaigning is more negative than now than it was back then. Why do you think that?
Well, I think there's just more of an inundation factor. And also, in the old days, let's say in the 19th century, there were people writing up really scurrilous, you know, ugly pamphlets and not signing them. But they were handing them around door to door. And that same kind of equivalent thing, I think, is people getting on blogs and posting any kind of comments they want, some of which, you know, really over the top. But it's a lot more accessible, and it's happening every day.
Hmm. Interesting. Ron, going back to the South Carolina question, it's become kind of part of the folklore of campaign coverage that South Carolina, you know, watch out, the gloves really come off. First of all, what contributes to that reputation, and is it really deserved?
To some degree, it's deserved. To some degree, there has been a history of that in South Carolina. One of the best practitioners, or worst practitioners, if you will, of negative campaigning in our lifetimes was Lee Atwater, who came from South Carolina and worked for Ronald Reagan. He actually invented the South Carolina primary to help Ronald Reagan in 1980, and it worked. And it helped Ronald Reagan get the nomination that year. And South Carolina subsequently voted for the person who won the Republican nomination in every four-year contest. He also worked for George H.W. Bush and then died at rather an early age. The Lee Atwater method was to, you know, you found something that was based in truth. That's mostly that's usually the most effective kind of ad, something that's got a little piece of truth. And then you push it. You stretch it. You get it into a place where it connects to people's mythological fears and so on. There is a tradition in most states, really, of some campaigns getting particularly nasty. And oftentimes it takes place in the primaries where you would think that people would be more civil with the folks that are in there. their party. But oftentimes, because there isn't that much difference between them on the issues, since they are in the same party, they get quite nasty on a personal level. And I think we're seeing some of that in this particular South Carolina go-around. And we surely saw it in the infamous case of 2000 when the George W. Bush campaign disavowed any information about this nasty rumor that was going around about John McCain having an illegitimate black child. Okay, that was a big thing that was going around, and it wasn't necessarily being owned up to by anybody's campaign. Well, of course, the basis in truth there was that he had an adopted child from Bangladesh, a very dark-skinned child, and it was clear in the family pictures that this child looked a little different from some of the other McCain
children. And did it work?
Yes, I don't think there's any question, but that took root and was a problem for the McCain campaign, and they had to address it.
And the relationship apparently was broken for many years as a result of that, as I recall.
Between George W. Bush and—
personal tension between those two. So, Rosemary, before we let you go, who has endured the worst attacks in history from your perspective? I mean, just really piled it on.
Well, you know, there's so many good candidates, but I always like to pick Al Smith, the 1928 election when he ran against Herbert Hoover, because people attacked him from so many different directions. He was Irish-American. He was working class. He had a heavy New York accent. He was in favor of ending Prohibition, which made people call him an alcoholic.
Oh,
but the main thing was the Catholicism, of course, and there was just a huge anti-Catholic orchestrated campaign against him that included the KKK and, you know, lots of other bad things.
All right. Well, there's certainly a benchmark we can measure against as we go forward. Rosemary Osler is author of the book Slinging Mud, Rude Nicknames, Scurrilous Slogans, and Insulting Slang from Two Centuries of American Politics. She was with us from Eugene, Oregon. With us here in Washington, D.C., Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, poetry may have an important place in literary history, but does it have a future? We'll hear about efforts to bring new life to that art form. That's a little later in the program. But first, we want to revisit the story about that controversial Mexican-American studies program that was suspended earlier this month in Tucson, Arizona's public schools. That came after Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, John Hoopenthal, found the courses in violation of state law, a law that he in fact helped write. The law bans, among other things, classes that can cause, quote, resentment towards other races or groups of people. We spoke with Mr. Hoopenthal yesterday, and he said the classes violated the rule. I want to play a short clip of our lengthy conversation.
To tell young kids that they can't get ahead, that they're victims in a country in which Barack Obama was president, it defies what we know. We know that you can engage in America, you can get ahead, that these kids can succeed.
If you want to hear the entire interview, just go to our website, go to npr.org and select Tell Me More from the Programs tab. We thought it was important to get a different perspective, so we've called upon Adelita Grijalva. She is a member of the Tucson Unified School Board, and she cast the lone vote in support of the program after Mr. Hoopenthal's decision, and she is with us now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you had the opportunity to hear our conversation with Mr. Hoopenthal, and I just wanted to ask, when you first heard these questions raised about the Mexican-American Studies program, and this dispute has been going on for some time now, what was your reaction?
Initially, our reaction was, we're in compliance with the law. In the law, it highlights areas that would be in violation of the law, like promoting the overthrow of the government, promoting ethnic solidarity, promoting design for one ethnic group. And I thought, you know, these classes are not out of compliance with those. So our initial stance was, we're not out of compliance, whether we agree or disagree with the law. I mean, that was going to be our position. And so initially there was an audit. We did an internal audit of the program, and there were found to be no issues. And that's when the data started coming out that the students in Mexican American Studies in TUSD are more likely to graduate high school, do better in AIMS, and go on to higher education than students that are not taking these courses. And so I think that that's important to highlight, and one of the reasons why these programs were initially created was a response to the mandates of No Child Left Behind, to basically address the issue that minority children have lower academic success than their non-minority counterparts.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, which is, what do you think the benefit of these courses has been or is or would be? Well, the courses have been suspended, so what do you think the primary benefit of them has been?
Essentially, 11 years later, we started this program in 2002, and 11 years later, we have created a program that does meet the needs of these children and is showing academic gains in all subject areas, even if, you know, the classes that they're taking are a history course or a literature course, their math scores, reading scores, everything else is improved. And they're going to college at a higher rate than their non-Mexican-American studies peers.
Well, Mr. Huppenthal disputes those gains, so let's set that aside because we can't resolve that here. What about the substance of his argument and the argument of his predecessor as state superintendent that these courses create a sense of grievance, that they create a sense of victimization, and that they spur resentment among particularly the Mexican-American students taking them toward their white peers and toward the society at large? How do you respond to that?
You know, I really feel like, on the contrary, the courses teach our students that they can rise up over any obstacle, over any form of oppression. It discusses what the Mexican-American experience has been in our history. The students leave basically believing that they can not only change their lives, but they can change the world. These classes show, you know, these students that they have a right to an education, a right to vote, a right to equal protections that generations before them fought for, and they should take advantage of those opportunities.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about that dispute over that now suspended Mexican-American Studies program in Tucson, Arizona schools. Our guest is Adelita Grijalva. She cast the lone vote on the Tucson School Board to preserve the program after the state school superintendent voted to suspend it at the risk of, it needs to be said, millions of dollars in financial penalties if the school board failed to suspend the program. We heard from the state superintendent on yesterday's program. So why do you think that these classes became the object of concern?
It really comes down to a guest speaker that one of our high schools, Tucson High, had during Cesar Chavez Week. And Dolores Huerta made a statement that we put on our website. As you know, she was a guest speaker. It was put on our website, and different people heard it and reported it as an issue. And one of the comments that she made was, Republicans hate Latinos. And so Tom Horn, who was then the superintendent of schools, came down with his right-hand person, Margaret Dugan, who is a Republican and is Latina, and wanted to speak to the children to address that issue. And so they were obviously allowed into the school. Students came into an assembly, and students asked, can we ask questions? Because usually they just raise their hand up and ask questions. And Mr. Horn said, you write the questions down, I will review the questions, and I'll pick out questions I want to ask. And so the students felt that they were being censored. And so they did a political demonstration. They put tape over their mouth and stood up during the presentation. And he felt that was incredibly disrespectful and tied it back to these classes and the things that they were learning.
Yeah, we asked about that. I asked Mr. Huppenthal about that, and he kind of acknowledged that it was partly about that, but he said it's bigger than that. You think that sort of all these years later, it's about that one assembly?
I do. I think that that started it, started the ball rolling, and then there were some exchanges between TUSD and the state, because TUSD has always felt that this is an issue of local control, and we should decide as a school district what curriculum takes place in our classes. And so up until January, there was not a willingness on the majority of the board to change or cease offering these courses. And so really, that just happened in January. And I think that, unfortunately, I have colleagues on the board that don't see the value, that feel like history isn't being taught with a balanced view. Well, I wonder how you teach some of these parts of our history without being one-sided. I mean, how do you talk about the fact that there is a sign that is in one of our picture books that students can no longer access that says, no Mexicans or dogs allowed? That is a picture that was taken in a part of our history. And I feel like, unfortunately, we're moving in a direction in this country where we're rewriting history and eliminating or downplaying the unsavory parts that we don't want to remember.
Adelita Grijalva is a member of the Tucson Unified School District, and she was kind enough to join us from her office in Tucson, Arizona. Ms. Grijalva, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. Here's a question about the way we live now. Is poetry dead? Now, Newsweek magazine asked that question in a column 8 years ago, and it sparked a spirited rebuke, mainly by poets. But ask yourself, is poetry important to you and the people you know? What would you say? Well, writer Lauren Wilcox asked that question in a cover story, and the answer might surprise you. And she's with us now. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Also with us is Alan King. He is a writer in residence at Hart Middle School here in Washington, D.C. And we'll talk about why Hart has a writer in residence. And Alan, thanks so much for joining us also.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lauren, let's just start by asking, why are people still asking if poetry is dead?
Right. Well, I think there is this sense that it was much more alive 50 years ago. And I think that's part nostalgia and part it was taught a lot more rigorously in the schools. And the scene was smaller and everybody was much more familiar with the books and the major poets that were out there.
But is it a question of whether poetry is dead or has it just moved into different neighborhoods?
Exactly. I think that's part of it. Poetry has been living in academia primarily for the last 50 years, I feel like. However, it's been really vital in the streets. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, couldn't you argue that rapping is a form of poetry? And certainly people are familiar, most people are familiar with slamming, right?
Yes, right. There's that rapping. I think poetry lives in a lot of places now.
And speaking of which, Alan, let's go to you now. I think some people might be surprised that there is such a thing as a writer in residence at a middle school, particularly, let's just say it, in an urban system like Washington, D.C. I'm wondering, first of all, what do you do? And how does poetry figure into your work?
Okay. Well, on a typical day, I would go in early and would do a poetry exercise with Ms. Harrington's social studies class. And then do another one later on that day with another teacher. And then we have the after-school program that we do called the Writing Club.
And Lauren points out in her piece that the Poetry Club has as many members as the football team. Now, Alan, tell me about that. And I'm sure your charming personality has something to do with it.
A lot of that is the kids themselves. The kids have formed friendships. There's an incentive for the kids to want to come through because this is a program where, a lot of kids who have been teased or picked on, they kind of find their niche when they come to this group.
Yeah, Lauren, what's your take on it? Why do you think the Writing Club is as popular as it is?
I think it provides an outlet that every 13-year-old can use, this place to record their feelings and express things that they might not be telling anybody else.
Alan, the piece makes the point that some of the Poetry Club's most loyal members are also kids who have been kicked out of other activities, who basically had a reputation for being, the one, that one.
Well, we know kids would be kicked out of certain programs, so we made it a point not to turn away any of the kids. We do deal with kids that have some behavioral issues, but we have help from the school social worker.
But despite that, it doesn't have the reputation as being the place for the problems. I mean, it is a highly sought-after activity. It's quite popular. People really want to go. They're very loyal to it. It's interesting, too, that poetry... I don't know if any of you have seen the film Pariah that's making such a big splash on the festival circuit by, first-time filmmaker Dee Reese. And the central character is an LGBT teen who's struggling with her identity. And guess what her outlet is? It's the Poetry Club. Mm-hmm. So Lauren, wouldn't that suggest that maybe poetry isn't dead after all? So again, the question kind of reverts to, is it that this, because it's taking a form that is not so academic,
absolutely,
that that's somehow not as prized?
I think that's part of it. I think that it can be a little more under the radar. I think also there's so many different kinds of poetry that are springing up. It's in so many different places now that it's not like before where you had the major publishers telling you what were the big poets that you needed to be reading. The scene is quite various, and it makes it a little hard to get a grasp on.
We're speaking with writer Lauren Wilcox. Her cover story is in this week's Washington Post magazine, and she's asking if poetry is dead. She's here with us along with Alan King. He is writer in residence and a poet at Hart Hart Middle School in Washington, D.C., and his work is featured in the story. Lauren, you know, the piece also describes a visit with the Federal Poets. That's a group of federal workers who write poetry and get together to share their work. Now, I think that's probably also surprising.
And I should just add, Michelle, that it was started as only for federal workers, and now it's open to anyone. So some of them do and some of them don't work for the government. So.
But if you compare, again, this is a different age group, and we were talking about how middle school kids are at an age where there are things that they need to talk about and share, and poetry is a wonderful outlet for them to do that. But what about these folks? Why do they love it so much? Why are they so committed to it?
Well, so just like the kids at Hart, none of these folks are professional poets, and yet it is a really strong and necessary outlet for them to kind of process through some of the stuff in their life that they wouldn't otherwise be doing any other way.
So Ellen, you're a poet. I mean, if you know, we're words people. I mean, you can imagine we love it. And frankly, next month we'll be doing something we did last National Poetry Month. We invite our listeners to submit poems at Twitter length and have gotten a, you know, terrific response to that. But I'm wondering is, if you walk into a room and say, people say, what do you do? Common question in Washington, D.C. And you say, I'm a poet. What reaction do you get?
Oh, what's your 9-to-5? Oh, I'm a poet. Oh, I wrote a little bit of poetry when I was in elementary school, and that's good.
And so what do you think that response says about the state of poetry in our country today?
Well, like when you look at how poetry is placed in terms of priorities, you know, sometimes poetry is kind of seen as a hobby. I think the question that gets asked a lot is, okay, you have these kids doing poetry. Well, what's so practical about it? Why not have them do something where they're going to make money or be able to get a job?
So, and your answer is?
Well, my answer is that poets are society's conscience. I had a residency, and poet was giving a talk, and said the job of the poet was to speak to those hidden places, to tell those stories about the people who die in those hidden places, and therefore humanizes them. And I think the other best answer, too, for that is that for a lot of these kids who don't have an outlet or any way of expressing, poetry for them gives them that self-confidence that they need to be able to accomplish anything else. You know, the fact that they have a voice to communicate their concerns and stuff, they're able to hold their heads high in a society that tend to look more at what's stacked against them.
And Ellen, given that you have seen for yourself the transformative power of poetry with some kids, what does their love of that art form say, do you think, about the prospects for poetry in this country?
Well, I think their love for it, because there's also, like what Lauren was talking about, how poetry has lived in academia for so long. And so I guess, like, their response would really be the alluding to poetry moving into other neighborhoods, poetry becoming more accessible, people not feeling that they have to be of some certain class to in order to enjoy poetry. So I think it speaks to the accessibility of it. It speaks to how necessary it is in our lives. And a lot of times you hear people say, poetry saved my life. And in most cases, they're not lying. You know, if they didn't have that outlet, who knows what else they would have done.
With us from Washington, D.C., Alan King. He is writer in residence at Hart Middle School. He is also a poet himself. Lauren Wilcox is a writer. She penned the cover story in this week's Washington Post magazine. It's titled, Is Poetry Dead? And she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The global fight against apartheid took decades to win. That term refers to the laws adopted by the South African government in the 1940s that racially segregated people in almost every area of life, from where they could sit, to where they could eat, to where they could live, to whom they could marry. But black and brown South Africans fought back in a way that grabbed the world's attention. Grassroots movements spread around the world, from sports arenas to college campuses.
At the University of Illinois, 60 students were arrested at a meeting of school trustees.
Anti-apartheid protests at the University of California, Berkeley campus seemed a throwback to the free speech demonstrations of the 1960s.
South Africa needs the investment of the Western democracies.
This epic story is captured in the film series Have You Heard from Johannesburg? It features interviews with key players from across the generations. It has already won several awards from film festivals around the world, and this month it is making its U.S. broadcast premiere on PBS. The series is being shown in three installments. The first came last Thursday, and the second comes today. And producer, writer, director Connie Field joins us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Do I have this right that it took 10 years to do this series?
Oh, you do have it right, and given then some. This was a very enormous story to capture, and it was also a story that had never been told before in any medium. No one has sort of looked at this story from a global perspective, and I went on a global gathering of, you know, interviewing people. I interviewed over 140 people all over the world, collected footage from all over the world. And also being an independent, actually, I did raise a good deal of money for this project, but not as much as would have allowed you to hire as many people as you need to make it go as quick as possible. So all these things, you know, took their time.
Well, I can imagine so. And you are a veteran of, you're an independent filmmaker, as you mentioned, you're a veteran. You've done previous films about the civil rights movement, and you do see the analogies here, but I did want to ask you specifically why you were attracted to this.
Well, I got attracted to this because it was a global story. We live in a world that is very interconnected, getting more and more interconnected day by day. For those of us who care about changing the world and trying to make it better and more equitable, it means that we really have to work on a global level. This is what this campaign did. And it operated, to use a cliche, act locally but think globally.
Well, I want to hear more about that. That's an interest, exactly, when we talk about just how the campaign ensued. But before we do that, I do want to mention that you introduce people to names that they may have heard but aren't really quite sure exactly what they did. And you bring these figures into sharp focus. One of them was Oliver Tambo. He served as president of the African National Congress, the ANC. He lived in exile for decades. And while he was in exile, he went around the world trying to get support for the anti-apartheid movement. I just want to play a short clip about him from the film. Here it is.
Colleagues worry about me in the ANC, but I myself expect that I will be killed by the regime or its agents.
What was his success, and how did he do what he did?
He is really the figurehead. I mean, everybody knows this story and this movement through the face of Nelson Mandela, who, when you look at what happened, was in jail the majority of this time. And it was Oliver Tambo who was sent out of South Africa in 1960 when all the political organizations were banned in South Africa. The ANC shipped him off and said, "You need to lead us from exile," which is what he did. So he not only spoke to people all over the world, he's the one who actually kept that organization together. Most organizations like that, if they're in exile that long, they fall apart. So it was an extraordinary job that he did on that level. He also was an amazing person. He would conduct a meeting so that by the end of the meeting, people would think ideas that he had at the beginning were their ideas at the end. And he was very much a diplomat, was quite successful in talking to people all over the world to get them to join in the struggle to isolate the Afrikaner regime.
So he had remarkable skills, remarkable leadership skills, remarkable diplomatic skills, organizing skills, just a remarkable figure.
He was, and he built everything from nothing. I mean, when he left the country, they had nothing. They didn't have any money. They didn't have places to stay. He built all of this, largely starting with organizations in countries like England that were early on in the 50s active around South Africa.
Connie Field, you also spent a lot of time in the film talking about Stephen Biko. That's a name that another name many Americans might remember. He was the subject of a feature film some years ago. He was a black South African intellectual. He had a huge influence, but he was killed in police custody. You know, his death even led the musician Peter Gabriel to write a song in his honor. Let me just play a short clip of that. You know, it's almost cruel to ask you to encapsulate, you know, all this history into just a few short words, but just briefly as you can, could you just tell us a little bit more about what Stephen Biko's death meant to the movement?
Steve Biko was the leader of the next generation of young South Africans who got brought in to fight for their liberation. And he was known all over the world, not just in South Africa. And there were lots of exchanges between him and the African-American movement here in the United States and the Black Power movement. And what he did for people in South Africa was to kind of break the shackles of racism, making you feel that you are a lesser person than you are, the psychological problems of oppression. And his death and the Soweto uprising was so enormous and affected the world to the point that the United Nations, which actually is very hard to move. It certainly was on South Africa. You could get nothing passed by the Security Council. For the very first time, passed arms embargoes against South Africa. And that's directly related to the Soweto uprising and the murder of Steve Biko.
We're speaking with producer, director, writer Connie Field about her documentary series, Have You Heard from Johannesburg? It describes the history of the anti-apartheid movement. In the second installment of the series, which is being shown on PBS tonight, and you'll want to check your local listings for exact times, this is where the U.S. side of the story comes into focus. You know, you describe how African-Americans staged protests outside the South African embassy in Washington, D.C. People in Washington may remember this because many figures, you know, major figures went there to get arrested. Let's play a short clip from the film where we hear from some members of the group. This is Cecilia Counts and Sylvia Hill.
Once we started to get a pattern of celebrity arrests at the embassy, it gave regular people more courage to participate.
The vast majority of the people who got arrested were everyday working people. And tears still come to my eyes. And this woman came one day, and she was in her 60s, and she said to me, "This is so hard for me. I spent all my life trying to stay out of jail. But I just have to do this because it's the right thing to do."
Now, you were telling us earlier that this phase of the story was actually news to you, which is interesting to me because you are a student of the civil rights movement in this country. As we said, you've made films about it. So tell me a little bit more about this.
Well, this was one of the stories we discovered in the editing room. Oh, my goodness. This is what's happening. It starts here. It's very significant for African American history because it's really the first time in a significant way that they affected and changed U.S. foreign policy. And it's a phenomenal story because it's really the legacy of the civil rights movement that allowed this to happen. One of the things the civil rights movement did, it ushered in black politicians. And they were in city government, and they were in state government, and they were in the U.S. government. And you had U.S. congressmen sitting in and getting arrested. When do you see this today? And it really, gave encouragement to people all over the country. And also during that time, the real movement for us in America in the 80s was the divestment movement. And this was to get your university, like here at UC Berkeley, to take their money out of corporations that were doing business in South Africa.
Why did it work? What's your analysis at the end of the day about why that strategy worked?
There's two things about that strategy. One, it's a great strategy for building a movement because everybody can do it. When you're trying to do something, if you can come up with a tactic like that, people did it in their churches. They did it in their unions. They did it in their cities. They did it at their colleges. Anywhere, because the fact we're pretty privatized in this country and everybody's pensions are in the stock market, you have leverage. So that's one thing that was really significant about it. The other thing was this happened in the 80s because there was a mass unstoppable movement in South Africa. That's what really caused things to move. I mean, people started pushing to get corporations to leave South Africa starting in the mid-60s. It didn't really happen till the mid-80s. And it's because of what was happening in South Africa. That's the story I'm telling. You can see that it's the interplay with what they were doing in South Africa with then what the world could do also about that.
Well, the other thing about the film that I think is important to note is that you also talk to people who are on what many people might say now were on the wrong side of history. You talk with members of the South African government. You talk with U.S. senators who were voting to, you know, not to put sanctions on South Africa. And you talk to corporate executives who didn't want to pull their business out of the country. Tell me about some of the insights that you gleaned from there, these interviews.
They were, I mean, I did it because you need to do that to tell a story. And these people were part of this history. They were on the other side. It was an incredibly fascinating story with Barclays Bank. I think they were some of my favorites to interview, though I think the CEO of Shell was really my favorite.
Well, was it hard to get them to talk to you? I mean, obviously, when people are on the winning side, you know, obviously everybody wants to take a victory lap. But was it hard to get these folks to talk?
Well, no. I started this fairly early. And I think most people always thought, you know, they were against apartheid. They weren't for apartheid. What I got out of the interviews, though, was what really made them leave. And for those who didn't leave, like Shell, what they felt about it. And things affected each of these different corporations differently. Barclays pulled out largely because they were so successful in Britain of students leaving Barclays banks in their accounts that Barclays was actually losing too much money.
Hmm. And finally, before we let you go, some people listening to our conversation may be wondering about Nelson Mandela. And it's not that he's an afterthought. That's not the case. But there is not a whole lot about him in the film. I'm just curious about that. Some people say that it was an ANC strategy to kind of make him the face of the ANC. And I'm just interested in what your reporting says about that. And
it was. In 1978, as I said before, Mandela was in jail this whole time. In 1978, they decided that it's more effective if you can have a face, a person who can be symbolic of your whole movement. And they chose to make that Mandela. And the first thing they did was celebrate his 60th birthday in a big, big, huge celebration. And they named stadiums after him. They named rooms after him at universities. They named a scientific discovery after him. I mean, there's this long list of things people did all over the world that eventually made Nelson Mandela a household name. And that's why when he came out of jail in 1990, everybody knew who he was.
Yeah, and that is one of the most amazing scenes in the film where you just talk about just the, it was like a worldwide moment, you know, people crying. And it was just an amazing moment, which your film captures. So, Connelly Field, before we let you go, what do you hope people will draw from the film?
Courage, that to not sound too bland, but that they can change the world. This was a great victory that we won to bring the world closer to be a more equitable place. We have a big agenda in front of us. Those who are active, like in Occupy Wall Street and other places all over the world that are acting now to try to bring economic equality to the way we live with each other in countries. That's a very big agenda. It seems almost impossible. But I hope watching this, where it seemed to many people active in the anti-apartheid movement that they would never see this change in their lifetime. You know, even though people were against the notion of apartheid, this country had the strongest army. And it had the support of two of the strongest nations in the world, the United States and Britain. It was a lot to bring this regime down. And people did it. And they fundamentally did it non-violently.
Kanye Field is the producer, writer, and director of Have You Heard from Johannesburg? It's being shown for the first time in the U.S. this month. It comes in three installments on PBS. Tonight brings the second chapter. You will want to check your local listings for exact times. And Kanye Field was kind enough to join us from Berkeley, California. Kanye Field, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
And let's listen to more of Peter Gabriel's song, Biko, honoring anti-apartheid activist Stephen Biko. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, Eamon Malone, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Bridget Armstrong. Our editors are Ahmad Omar and Alicia Montgomery, with help this week from Laurie Grant. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevolt. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The supervising senior producer is Carlene Watson. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow. Because